This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When Ashley Merriman last visited us, we had a lively conversation about trophy kids. We've raised a generation or two of children who have gotten a trophy just for participating in various activities, the theory being that it would be good for their self-esteem if they felt so honored. But Ashley Merriman was quick to point out that even the kids can see through this deception. They know who deserves a trophy and who doesn't. The upshot of all this is that these false rewards are a losing proposition. Yes, fake winning is, in fact, losing. So what about winning and losing? It turns out there's a science behind it, and understanding a bit of that science might help kids and adults learn how to be more successful. And isn't that what we all want? Ashley Merriman's latest book, or her book is now out in paperback with co-author Poe Bronson, is Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, and she's back to share some of what she knows about the topic. Welcome back. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
She joins us, by the way, from Boston, where it's very cold. You should have been here first. You should have come here on your way. Stop by.
It's very cold. Yes, I should have.
How did you and your co-author, Poe Bronson, become interested in the impact, first of all, of giving out trophies to every kid, and now the science of winning and losing? Did one lead to the other?
Actually, it did. In our previous book, Nurture Shock, we wrote about praise and how the research had found that constantly telling kids, you're so smart, you're so talented, actually had them struggle more when they had an experience of failure. And they were actually more likely to underachieve rather than the sort of building fearless self-confidence we'd anticipated. And because of that, we sort of were saying, well, if everybody shouldn't get a trophy, who should and why? So that was sort of a lingering question.
Isn't that clear? I'm sorry to interrupt, but isn't that clear?
That it should be just when they win?
Yeah.
Well, no, but the question, but in terms of, you know, how many kids, you know, if it's not everybody, okay, well, is it one or zero or 30%? And, you know, what are, you know, should only experts win? What about novices? Because some people are saying, well, you know, a preschooler should get more trophies because they're little and it's hard. The research actually found the opposite, that experts, you know, are motivated by trophies, but, you know, kids who are just learning for an activity don't need trophies. So those kinds of questions were sort of fascinating me. But then I really was amazed by research by the University of Michigan professor Steve Garcia. And Steve and his co-author, Avraham Tor, found that by looking at every SAT score in 2005, that the more students who took the SAT at the same place at the same time, the lower everyone's scores. And I said, what? Do that again? And yeah, the more students who go and take the SAT at the same place, the lower their scores. And I asked Steve, I said, well, what's going on? He said, well, competition is personal. It's important to be able to look over at the other kid next to you and say, he studied more vocabulary than I did, but I think I can take him on the math. And we have this idea that, you know, I can be lost in the crowd. You can't find me. But Garcia says we lose ourselves in the crowd because it's just so overwhelming to have this sort of nebulous everyone's around that you lose your own sense of focus and ability, so that competition's personal. And when he said that, I started saying, I need to know more about competition and understanding it.
Did it surprise you that there has been so much research into this and that there is, in fact, a science behind winning and losing? Did you know that before you started this investigation?
Well, I knew that there was science in different fields. But actually, what was amazing to me was when I started, people were saying, oh, I don't really work on the science of competition. I do the science of social comparison, which, of course, is about how people compete, right? Mm-hmm. Or I do peer relations, or I do peer pressure. And even over the course of writing the book in about 3 years, more researchers were like Steve and saying, I actually studied the science of competition. So they themselves were thinking about it in terms of a field, whereas even when I started writing the book, they were studying competition, but that wasn't how they branded it themselves.
So if I've got this right, one of the major pieces of information in this book, and even your last book to a certain degree, imparts that losing is good for you. I mean, is that really true? I mean, for some, it can certainly spur them on to learn from their mistakes, which might propel them to victory later on. But it seems to me losing can also leave you in the dust. It can crush you, never to get up to fight for another day. I mean, why is it good for you to lose?
Yeah, one of those things, if it, you know, it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. But mm-hmm. I'm always like, yeah, but sometimes it kills you,
yeah.
Right? That's a problem. Well, you know, I think what's important to understand is I'm not saying we need to humiliate people, especially kids. I'm not saying go find experiences of losing because that had so much fun. No, losing hurts. No one enjoys losing. Why it's good for you is because, especially for kids, is it's not about losing. It's about resilience and moving past the loss. It's about learning from that experience and saying, okay, what am I going to do differently? And I worry that if everyone, especially young kids, were always winning, 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 there's no impetus to improve. There's no impetus to be resilient because you just take it for granted that you're going to win. And a Hungarian researcher, she studied the most common responses to wins and to losses. And the most common response to a loss, not surprisingly, is sadness. Mm-hmm. And the most common response to winning, again, not surprising, joy and satisfaction at, you know, doing something that you knew you could do. But what's interesting is she also found that the good loser is the good winner. And the bad loser is also the bad winner. And in that case, that's a person who feels entitled to the win. They don't respect the other guys. They don't respect the competition. They just say, I'm so great. If you had realized that, you'd have given me the trophy before we even started. And that's the problem. And that's why experiencing loss and experiencing that you can get past this and think of things differently, that's the value in losing.
Well, you write about the joy of winning, you just mentioned that, and the character building agony of defeat. And most mm-hmm. people would agree with you on the agony part of that. But is it always true that losing builds character, or is that something that we say to put the best face on the fact that we lost?
Well, you know, I've thought about this a lot, actually. And I mean, I've interviewed Olympians and, you know, they give you everybody, we just watched it, right?
Mm-hmm.
They give you the medal, they give you the flowers, they kiss you on the cheek a couple times. But then they don't say, but remember, it's not if you won or lost, it's how you played the game. Mm-hmm. We only say that to the losers. In fact, actually, FIFA, for the World Cup, there's actually a prize for good sportsmanship, and none of them want it because they only give that to the loser. And they're all saying, wow, if I'm a good sport, then I clearly was not fighting hard enough to win the World Cup.
Well, we just sat through the Olympics, weeks and weeks of the Olympics, in which a lot of athletes thought to be shoe-ins for the gold medal, went home mm-hmm. with something less, and in some cases, nothing at all. What should they take away from that experience?
Well, you know, it's going to depend on each individual, but generally, what you have to start, you know, and this is sort of natural, actually, for all loss, and this is another reason why losses are better than wins, because in a loss, you're forced to think about what you did wrong and what would you do differently. And no one does that with a win.
Mm-hmm.
People take a win, and maybe it's sort of that don't look a gift horse in the mouth, but they go, oh, well, I won, so I'm going to be great. And the next time I'm going to do it, I'm going to win then too. Well, at one point, I saw one of the speed skating short track, the leader was taken out because someone else tripped.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
three people suddenly crashing into the wall.
Yes, I saw
well,
that.
Well, if the winner of that race says, well, I'm going to win next time, and doesn't realize the reason they won is because half of the field was taken out, then they may not prepare as much for that next Olympic race.
All of these competitions in the Olympics have something to do with skill, no question about it, and ability,
yes.
and, ability and years and years and years of tireless preparation. There's no question about any of that.
Mm-hmm.
But then you have events like speed skating, which is based on time.
Mm-hmm.
And ice skating, which is based on somebody else's opinion of how you've done in very, very different technical categories. Is there a difference in how people look at winning and losing in those events? Because it's not all to the clock or the number of points you scored because you made a basket. It's the number
right.
of points you scored because somebody thought that you made those points.
Right. It's incredibly important, especially in a judged event, and there are more of them now, right? I mean, mm-hmm. even just thinking about all the snowboarders doing flips, those were all judged events. People have books and decide. And the most important response people have after a win or a loss is determined on whether or not they thought that the competition was fair. So, I mean, we just saw that with the women's figure skating. The Russian wins the gold medal, and around the world, people are signing a petition saying, that's not fair. Mm-hmm. And then the other response people get is, see, that's why figure skating is not a sport, mm-hmm. because there are judges and it can be unfair. So it's very important, especially in those judge circumstances, that people have an understanding exactly of where the scores come from and that they can be perceived to be neutral.
But
the problem with figure skating is you had all of those Russian-affiliated judges who are hugging right. the winner. People are saying, no, that's not fair. If they had thought she was, you know, legitimately getting it, then they wouldn't have objected. And what's really fascinating is the sort of, you know, the speed skating. The original Olympic sports were actually chosen for the very reason you talked about, which is that it was a wrestling game, a boxing game, chariot races, foot races, and that everyone in the stadium could say, he won. Mm-hmm. Without any sort of political mm-hmm. discussion on what was good or what was bad. And they specifically picked events where there was a clear winner and a clear loser, and it wasn't going to be so fuzzy in terms of opinion.
Which is why we like sports, but it seems to me that figure skating is more like life.
Because it's always a little hard to know what's going on.
Because it's completely
yeah.
subjective and political.
You know, that's really fascinating. I'm going to have to think about that. What I do think is sort of fascinating in the flip side, though, is a researcher at Bryn Mawr, Robert Washington, says that the other sports, like speed, like mm-hmm, racing, mm-hmm. are actually the drivers for democracy. And they're actually the drivers for cleaning up corrupt societies. And what his argument is, and you can see this right now going on with India and cricket, you know, the American expressions would be, you know, it's a don't hit below the belt or it's a fair playing field, right? Mm-hmm. And so we use sort of baseball and boxing metaphors in terms of what's up front. But in the UK and in India, they say that about cricket. It's cricket means it's an upfront game. It's not cricket means there's something fishy going on. Well, right now in India, cricket's not cricket. They're having corruption scandals. And they have corruption scandals in the rest of India. And Washington says that people start looking at baseball, football, and these scores where everybody can watch it and say, I know what happened. And they start demanding that same sort of transparency in other aspects of society. You know, why can't I just find the box scores on the Pentagon or a congressman or the lobbyist so I know exactly what they're doing? And we start demanding these sort of check marks so that we can understand it. Because right now, you know, the Pentagon depends on the Pentagon spokesman telling you how it went, and mm-hmm. you're supposed to believe him. So that these other sports can actually catalyze people saying, no, I want the information. And that's why sports scandals, including figure skating, hurt so much.
Ashley Merriman's our guest, co-author of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. We're coming back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hendrick Acura, introducing the new fuel-efficient 2014 RDX and MDX sport utility vehicles with up to 90 cubic feet of convertible cargo space. Details at HendrickAcura.com. Well, the annual pilgrimage is underway. That's the one where high school students and their parents start checking out colleges. They're going all over the country looking at schools. They're making applications to schools. They're trying to decide what's a nice fit for their young person. Well, all of this is a lot of cost involved in this, and a lot's at stake. And Charlotte's about to be the site of a huge college fair where students can meet with representatives from more than 100 colleges and universities. So we're going to talk to two college admissions experts about what's important for students and parents to ask and to know as they navigate this new world of higher education. And we'll do that tomorrow. at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Syrian government steps up airstrikes against civilians. The conflict there has already killed 140,000 and displaced millions more. The crisis in Syria and the world's failed response.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ashley Merriman's our guest. She's back with us again. First, she joined us to talk about Nurture Shock, her book with Poe Bronson about why we shouldn't be giving trophies to every kid just for participating. And now they're back with Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, just out in paperback. We were talking before the break about the Olympics, which we spent 17 days watching, many of us. And one of the late-night talk show hosts observed that in the case of the Olympics, hundredths of a second or a fraction of a point can make the difference between gold, silver, and bronze, and that a hundredth of a second or a fraction of a point can make the difference between being in the history books and being totally forgotten. So why do they give out silver and bronze when the athletes really don't want to stand there on the podium next to the gold medal winner and say, hey, I'm a loser? Or are they winners because they won second and third?
Well, actually, they've done studies about this, and Medvec actually looked at footage of athletes' reactions on the medal stand, and she found that if you're not going to win the gold, it's actually better to win the bronze than it is the silver.
Why?
Because the bronze people are thrilled to be there on the podium at all. Oh, my gosh. 1/100th of a second later, and I wouldn't have came up with a medal at all. Mm-hmm. I'm an Olympic medalist. The silver medalists are looking to their right saying, oh, my God, 1/100th of a second, and I would be there, not that guy. So they're sort of more focused on the failure of winning the gold rather than, oh, my gosh, I actually won a medal at all. Whereas the bronze are so excited that they actually made it, that they're having as big a grin as the gold medalist.
But I was thinking about this while I was watching. I forgot which event I was watching, but they were on the podiums, and I was thinking, okay, so that guy won the gold medal. Now what? Mm-hmm. He's spent God knows how many years, how many hours, how much money perfecting this incredible skill that no one else can do, and he's up there getting the gold medal. Now what? What drove him to that point? And what do you do with it once you've won it? Not the gold medal, per se, but just the fact that you've done it.
Right. Actually, it was interesting. There was an editorial in the Washington Post by an Olympic bobsledder. And he said he had spent, you know, most of his life perfecting running really fast and pushing a sled. And there wasn't really much call for that outside the Olympics. And he said, you know, if you get your car stuck in the snow, I can help you there. But other than that, it's a limited career. And what he's done is he's actually started a program coordinating current and former Olympians going into schools. And what are they talking about? Are they specifically saying, hey, you can be a bobsledder out of work like me? No. For them, and, you know, they've looked at, you know, Olympians afterwards, and I've spoken to many who've become doctors, lawyers, leaders in different fields in the government. And the Olympic training teaches you about perseverance. It teaches you about overcoming the odds. It teaches you to be fearless. And it also teaches you it takes a really long time to be good at something. Mm-hmm. So that sort of patience and willingness to keep pushing and not expecting things to happen overnight, those are traits that I think are valuable, you know, regardless whether or not there's a medal or a hospital or a law firm or trying to teach. You know, those are traits that we all want. And that's actually, you know, going back to that idea, you know, when is losing good for you? It's good for you when you pick up and move on.
You talk about home field advantage. And I don't want to spend too much more time on the Olympics, but during the skating competition, at least, the mm-hmm. commentators talked a lot about the home ice advantage of the Russian skaters because of the roar of the crowd and their appreciation for everything that they did. And, of course, a Russian won, at least the figure skating, mm-hmm. female figure skating competition. But there were other places where it didn't seem to matter that the Russians were up there and skiing or doing whatever they were doing because they didn't win. So what is the home field advantage? What is that advantage? Is it just the extra cheering? Is it the energy that comes at you from the crowd? Is it you simply feeling more at home, more comfortable, more in the zone when you're competing in familiar surroundings?
Well, there is a real thing called home field advantage. And the Olympics, actually, they just did a review of it a few months ago. Mark Jones did and found that the Olympic home field advantage only takes place in judged events like skating. But they have found home field advantage in NBA basketball teams. The NBA home team wins about 63% of the time. There's home field advantage in Major League Baseball, National League, National Hockey League.
Football?
Yes, there is in football, but not as strong as some sports. And what's weird, though, is everybody's like, well, so there is this thing, but why? And some people say, oh, well, it's travel. You know, if you're flying across the plane and you didn't even get in there until 3 o'clock in the morning, of course, you're going to be tired and not do as well during the next meet. However, Richard Pollard, a researcher, studied 37 professional teams, baseball, hockey, and football. And all they did was they moved cross town. They had a brand new stadium. You guys have got a brand new baseball stadium in downtown, so I want you to think about this. They lost their home field advantage the first season. There was no travel difference. There was no crowd difference. The fans were still there. The refs were still there. But they lost their home field advantage. Another weird study that made me go, well, what's going on here is Italian soccer. There was so much violence in the stands where, you know, people were actually, you know, getting drunk and having fights, the fans themselves, that the Italian parliament threatened to make the team owners liable for what bad things the fans might do. Mm. Now, the team owners obviously did not like that idea. So they closed the stadium and only had television of the games. So not a single fan is there, but the home team still won. So it's not the crowds, it's not the fans, it's not the refs, it's not the travel. Well, what is it? It's a sense of ownership. It's mine, and crucially, mine, not yours. And if you move to a new stadium, you don't get it as much because you don't own it. The Olympians, even the Russians, they didn't own that stadium because they had never practiced there either. Right? They had no sense of it. It was just they came and they showed up and they tried to figure the hotels. But what's amazing is Gordon Brown, a British researcher, has found that this same thing is operating anytime you have a business meeting. If you can get your salary negotiation in your office and not your boss's, you can get up to 160% more value from that meeting. If you show up to a restaurant first for a business meeting, sit down, move stuff, learn your waiter's name, and act like you own the place, because that changes the dynamic of the conversation. Because home field advantage is about seizing territory, and it happens almost instantaneously. It's not over 2 or 3 years. You can get it even in 10 or 20 minutes.
Wow. Because I know that you write about you can use home field advantage when you negotiate your salary at work and that you're more likely to get a raise if you have the salary conversation in your space, in your office, as opposed to that of your boss. But how unusual would it be, and particularly in these cubicle farms, you can't ask your boss for a raise with 15 other people sitting around listening to every word you say. How do you get that home field advantage? Because most of these conversations are going to take place on the boss's territory.
Because he wants the home field advantage.
Yes.
That's what makes him boss. Yeah, absolutely. And that's why people say, well, yeah, like I can never get it, that to happen. Like, exactly. But then you at least need to be aware that, you know, you don't have the home field advantage. Can you find at least a neutral place to talk? Hey, can we talk in the conference room? And then you get there early. It's not as good as being in the office, but at least it changes the dynamic a little bit. And obviously in other settings, you know, if you're in sales and you want to have a coffee, again, I'm saying get to that restaurant, get to that conference room early because you seize it. Home field advantage is, and the idea that we just have that sense of ownership is so powerful. One of my all-time favorite studies, they timed people leaving parking spaces at a mall. And it's not your imagination. if you're waiting for that space, they take longer to leave. Mm. Even though their goal is leaving, the idea that if I have to leave my space means giving it to you, people take a little bit less, more time, check in the mirror. Oh, I should make sure I don't have any more phone calls or texts before I do it. Simply because they own it and they don't want to give it to you.
You know, I have noticed that, and it drives me crazy.
Well, I can tell you, be a little bit further back and don't honk, don't use your blinker, because those actually make people take even longer.
So what does that say about me? Because I don't do that. I really think that particularly in a crowded parking lot when people are vying for spaces, I make it my goal to get into the car, start it, and even start moving the car before I fasten my seatbelt just to get out of the space to free it up. What does that say about me?
That you're a nice person. Thank you.
I'm a fool.
Well, I tried. I do the same thing, and I've tried, especially since I knew the study, to willfully get out because I know someone's there. But I've told people about it, and they sort of laugh, and they go, yeah, that's me. You know, or the other one, which is almost the same, especially in California, where no one uses their signal. Mm. Say, well, I can't use my signal because if I do, they'll speed up. And I know people who've also said that. You know, if I signal I'm coming into your lane, that means I'm taking your place, and people actually accelerate so that you can't go in front of them.
So that's competition. Are we all naturally competitive? Is it in our – are we wired to be competitive, for me to compete against you, to best you, at whatever it may be?
Right. I think we are. I mean – research from the very first study of sports psychology in 1898 by Norman Triplett, he looked at kids and he found that 50% of us do, you know, better in competition. Mm-hmm. You know, just having two people, you know, in the gym on treadmills, they start both picking up the pace.
That is true.
Right? So just having that other person there, even if they're not watching you, for most of us, improves us. For 25%, we're sort of immune. And then 25%, it actually hurts their performance. They get freaked out over the fact there's someone else there. So the key is we don't want to be in that category, those people who are suffering, because it's the minority. And there you have to say, well, you need to be in an environment where you've learned from this experience and you're not feeling that you're too quickly in a competitive environment. So you need more practice. You need to more focus on what you're doing and how you can improve rather than beating the other guy. And I think that's really important. And if we do that, then we all can benefit from competition.
Yeah.
You know, I do the opposite of the two people on treadmills in the gym. I have a crummy broken elliptical that I bought at a thrift store in my apartment. And when I'm not using it to dry laundry, which is most of the time, you know, I'll be on my elliptical and I'll be watching a rerun of, you know, NCIS thinking, oh, I am just so great. Look at me working out. Well, that's because there's no one else working out. If I went to the gym, I would realize what a real workout is.
Yeah.
But I don't do that because I want to know.
You know, historically, men have been looked upon as competitors because they have engaged in athletic pursuits to a greater degree than women because they could and women couldn't for the longest time. And those are pursuits in which there is usually a clear-cut winner and a clear-cut loser, which causes players to strive to best their opponents. Then, of course, there's this male bravado that men have, you know, this leader of the pack mentality or posing in which they kind of jockey for position or tell you how great they are, even though in their heart of hearts, they may not believe it themselves. Women compete as well, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, it was funny when we first started working on the book, my co-author, Poe Bronson, asked, should we write about gender differences in competition? And I said, absolutely not. I was militantly no. And the reason is I was afraid that the research would say, well, women are less competitive, they can't compete, and that's why they're still glass ceilings. It's women's fault because we can't cut it. Which would drive me insane, obviously. Mm-hmm. I'm competitive. Everyone I know is competitive. The idea women can't compete would drive me crazy. But we started changing our understanding when we saw research by Stanford's Muriel Niederle. And what Muriel does is she has you come into the lab and she says, okay, great. I want you to do this little math exercise. And I'll pay you for every problem you get right. Or if you want, you can be in this pool with four other people, and whoever scores the most correct answers, they win all of the money. So which do you want? 75% of the guys say, game on, I'm in. And only 35% of the women are willing to compete. Hmm. Now, a 40% difference, that's a lot, right? But it's not that women were afraid of taking the risks. It's that they're really good calculating their odds of success. And they look like, that's a lot of other people. It's better to get paid by the problem and I'll get some money than no money. So it turns out that women are really good at calculating their odds, while men are really good at ignoring the odds.
Which is the smarter strategy?
Well, if you want to compete, and sometimes it is. I mean, if you think about, you know, a Powerball, if you're standing
in line, that was the question. Which is this is the
smarter strategy?
Yeah, question mark.
I think women need to go for it more, and guys actually need to think a little bit more about the odds. And which one you do changes whether or not you're willing to compete. So women, I think, are under-competing, say, in job markets, where they're only putting themselves out and even applying when they know they're going to win, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I was talking to a Houston Oil executive female, and she was saying, well, there was a job I really wanted last week, but I only had 7 of the 10 qualifications, so I didn't apply. She took herself out of the running. And I said, it's not your job to say no. It's their job to say no. You're supposed to say, here's what I can offer, and they tell you if it's a fit. You're not supposed to take yourself out of the game before you even start.
Because you write that when women run for Congress, they win as often as men. So if there are fewer women in Congress, it is because they're not putting themselves forward. They aren't running. And I guess the same could probably be said for people at CEO-level positions and in boardrooms. They're not there in greater numbers because they haven't pushed themselves to be there because they've calculated the odds and realized, we may not win. One of our female producers took a look at that little factoid and she said, that means the women are competing smarter when they require better odds of winning before they will get into the game. Do you mm-hmm. agree with that? Because I say, if you don't play, you cannot win.
See? It's a guy and a girl. And look at the answers. You're both doing exactly what the research says. You know, I think that, you know, and we have to agree there is still gender discrimination out there. We can't say that, well, this is all about women non-competing. Of course, it's a factor. But beyond that, it doesn't explain everything. And the win to compete, I think in some ways really does. In 2012, do you know how many women decided they were going to run for governor and mm-hmm. actually took a step to do it?
No.
Four. That's it. Four. And I'm not talking about one a primary, one a general. I'm talking about went to a courthouse and filled out a form saying, I think I'm going to run.
Right.
Four. That's it.
Did they win?
Actually, 2012 was considered a really good year for elected women. And 2014 was as well. But it was like, wow, women now are 25% of Congress.
Ashley Merriman's our guest. We're talking about the science of winning and losing. And we'll continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and FX, presenting the original series The American, starring Kerry Russell and Matthew Reese. The new season premieres tonight at 10 only on FX. More at fxnetworks.com. The Syrian government steps up airstrikes against civilians. The conflict there has already killed 140,000 people and displaced millions more. And Diane Rehm and her guest will talk about the crisis in Syria and the world's failed response to that crisis coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. We, of course, are talking about winning and losing and the science of same. And if you'd like to join our conversation, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is where you can get your questions answered. We are coming right back.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers. Let's say you wanted to support your station with something other than cash.
Well, I donate my time. I have a restraining order against you. The answer is you could donate your used car.
Right. You get a tax deduction, a nice empty driveway, and the station gets the proceeds.
To arrange a pickup, call 1-866-789-TMCP.
TMCP?
Take my car, please.
That's 866-789-8627.
Or go to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins with Ashley Merriman, co-author with Poe Bronson of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, which is what we are talking about right now. And we were just talking about female politicians or women running for elected office, and they calculate the odds. And if they think they have a shot at it, they'll put their hat into the ring. But if they don't, they'll stay out, whereas men will say, okay, I'm in. Let's try this. So that women are better at calculating the odds and gauging risk, and men tend to be overconfident sometime.
Yes.
In an interview that you did with CNN, you said that when it comes to children, girls tend to develop friendships in pairs, and they believe that relationships are threatened when there are winners and losers. So girls tend to play games that encourage taking turns and foster sharing. Boys grow up in groups that encourage competition and differences of opinion and ability. So what, if anything, should parents do to mold their daughters and sons? How does this set up boys and girls as adults?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, these are not small differences. In lab studies where they'll have a group of kids in a room and they can play however they want, six-year-old boys will spend 74% of their time in a group activity, girls just 14%. And the boys, when they're in a pair, that interaction is about half as long as the girls' pair interaction. And if you put two boys in a room by themselves, do you know what they talk about, Mike?
No.
They say, wow, if there were a couple more boys here, we could have a game and yeah, that would be really fun.
Okay.
And so groups teach kids, well, you know, if you have a group of five or six or seven kids and they all meet every day to play ball, everybody understands not all of those kids are going to have the same level of ability, right? One kid will be the star athlete. One kid will be the bookworm who does everyone else's homework while they're all playing. Somebody's the class clown. And these groups give kids the comfort to be individuals and to have differences of ability and opinion. Whereas a pair is based on common ground, right? You can put the most ardent, you know, supporter of, you know, the Republicans and the most ardent Democrat, you put them alone in a room and they try and find common ground. They're not trying to find ways of disagreement immediately. And so these pairs teach women over time that to compete means to risk losing your best friend. So in a research with college-educated women, they found that women never talk about their achievements unless they know the person they're speaking to is equally or more achieving than they are.
How much of it has to do with a woman, a female's, whether they're a girl or a woman, that is immaterial, desire for that intimacy, that friendship that they find with the other person in their relationship, whereas a guy doesn't feel comfortable with that. They gravitate toward competition because that's the only way they can be together. That's
right.
The only common ground that they have that they feel comfortable participating in. Conversation gets in the way sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge part of it. You know, Anson Dorrance, UNC College, he was looking at, you know, how do I coach women's teams and men's teams differently? Mm-hmm. And at first he thought he would coach them the same. But for guys, you know, he says his best halftime speech was when he walked in, he paced around like an angry tiger and then kicked a trash can out through a window. Scared them all to get. Now, the girls, his best halftime speech was when he walked in and he said, well, what do you think? And the girl said, oh, I screwed up this, or I missed this pass, or I did this. And what he's realized is that you have to encourage girls to separate the intimate relationship and the drive to compete. And that you have to say, you know, when you're on the soccer field, you go as hard as you possibly can. It's not about being liked. When you're you know, when you're at home, when you're in the dorm, sure, you can have as close and intimate relationship as well. But when you're here in this game, you need to set that aside. And so he had to give the girls permission and encourage them to set those intimate relationships aside and really go for it.
You know, some people thrive in a competitive situation. They thrive on the stress of competition. Others get stressed out at the thought of competing. Mm-hmm. Do we understand what's happening in both those situations? And can you learn to use stress? If competition stresses you out, can you learn to use that to your advantage?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. The researchers talk about the biophysiology of challenge and threat. And I used to think there was a difference between psychology and physiology, and I've realized there isn't any. In a challenge state, you think, I can do this. Victory is not assured, but I've got a shot. I've prepared. It's a close race. I need to fight, but I can do this. And now we're talking about athletics, trying to get a promotion at work, whatever it is. And in a challenge state, your heart rate variability improves, your lungs, you get more oxygen through them, the blood vessels, every blood vessel in your body actually dilates to get more blood circulating. Your heart rate goes up, but your blood pressure doesn't. In a threat state, you're thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be a disaster. And the only question is, how bad is it going to be? And when you're in that mindset, your blood vessels actually contract. Your heart rate goes up, but your blood vessels are tightened. So now your blood pressure goes up. Your brain is racing. You're actually getting less oxygenated blood to the brain. So you're underperforming. But the research has found that if you reframe that moment of threat, the, oh my gosh, I'm going to fail. Say, no, no, you're not stressed. You're excited. You can actually change the physiology. A Harvard study that came out about 2 months ago found 90% of us, if you were told, hey, a friend of yours is really nervous, they have to give some big speech or some presentation, what would you tell them? 90% of us would say, well, you got to calm down. But that's actually the worst advice. Because if you're anxious and you're told be calm, then you start being anxious about the fact that you haven't calmed down. Right? So you're less and less paying attention to the task and more about the fact that you're not calm. And what you need to do is say, no, I'm excited. This is that opportunity. I'm not sure everything's going to be okay, but I have done that preparation. So you're changing your mindset back to that challenge state. And when you do that, it actually is improving the underlying physiology to get you there.
And you say this is actually this response mechanism that we have, whether it's a good response to competition or a bad one, it's actually in our genes. So we are born as winners or losers, or is there more to it than that?
Oh, there's more to it than that. Thank goodness. Well, actually, there's one particular genetic variation. The gene itself is called the COMP gene. And the COMP gene is responsible for the dopamine levels in your prefrontal cortex of your brain. So dopamine is this neurotransmitter that gets the synapses on your brain more excited and more focused and engaged. And on the average day, people with the MET allele, the researchers called them worriers. The worriers, you can already see where this is going, right? The worriers on an average day do really well. They have higher working memory, higher verbal IQ. They're focused. They're engaged. But in a period of stress, that brings dopamine too, and their brains overload. It's like flooding a car engine with gas. The worriers actually, on an average day, sort of underperform. They don't have enough dopamine to pay attention to class, to get all of the vocabulary words down. But when stress happens, now they have dopamine at an optimal level. So they actually need stress and tension to do their best. But getting to what you asked, the important thing is worriers who practice that specific stress, you know, pilots who are working in learning how to do navigation, race car drivers, they can over time, they don't change their genetic code, but in that specific context, it's called stress inoculation. They build enough skills to say, hey, I can handle this specific stress, and then they become better. So rather than saying, you know, genes are destiny, there are actually Navy SEALs who are warriors in their genes, but their job is a warrior. Mm-hmm. So you can be a warrior and do really well.
So let me see if I understand this. You're saying that those who have these genes, whose genes slowly clear this dopamine from their brains, are the ones who can these are the warriors, right?
Right.
They can reason, they can solve problems, they can orchestrate complex thought, they can better mm-hmm. foresee the consequences of something, and they can concentrate better. But those with
on average days.
Yeah.
And
so, those who are the warriors with genes that promotes this fast clearing of dopamine are at mm-hmm. a disadvantage until mm-hmm. stress enters the picture, and then
right.
they have the advantage. But you say you can exercise yourself so that as a warrior you can clear your dopamine quicker?
Well, it's about changing that rate of dopamine. So again, stress. Because dopamine is about engagement, mm-hmm. right? And stress is really engaging, right? That's when your attention is heightened and you forget right. anyone else is in the room because you're just So the stress also brings dopamine. So if you have experiences of stress in a particular kind over time, then your brain's not going to have that extra increase of dopamine. You're just going to stay where you were. And that's why you're doing better, because you already had a sufficient amount of dopamine to be successful. The problem was that the stress added too much on top, and that's when the warriors overload.
So aside from gender and from the influence of genes in all of this, in playing a role in competitiveness and winning and losing, does age play a role?
It does, but in a good way.
Okay.
One is that the research finds that, you know, people who are older are still competitive. It's not that you send them out to pasture and say, well, your time is done. But people who are older tend to be more selective about when they're going to compete. They're not going to compete on every single thing. But that's actually a good thing, because the better competitor does pick and choose the battles that are more important. They do understand that winning the love of your life, winning a job promotion is more important than that parking space they weren't going to give you, right? So that process of picking and choosing what competitions are important, what things that you're going to passionately believe for, and the other ones, you let go by, happens through age as well as experience. But what's important is that once you're in the competition that's important, it's just you're just as good a competitor. And the best example of that, I think, is a British study of surgeons. And they were studying males who were 40 to 62. And research says at that age, testosterone levels should be dropping. However, the morning before their most complicated surgeries, they had testosterone increases of up to 500%. So mentally, when they were engaged and excited about something that was important to them, they had the physiology that responded just as if they were a 19 or a 20-year-old. And the testosterone increase in the moment is just as relevant for women and men.
I've got 4 minutes left, and I got four things I want to ask you about. So let's see if we can
okay.
The lightning round begins. we talk a lot about testing in this program because we talk a lot about education, and a lot of people believe that tests, we test too much. And mm-hmm. and tests are a competition. They're a competition, if not among your peers, in your own mind, to best your previous score, to do well.
Absolutely.
You say that kids don't need less academic competition. They need more.
Right.
Is that what tests are?
Well, the important thing is that they need an ebb and flow to the competition. So it's not that we need constant testing and constant competing, that kids need to say, oh my gosh, there's a spelling bee coming up, there's a science fair coming up, and you work really hard, and then you have the competition, and then you have moments of rest. And the problem with constant testing is you don't have that time to have kids rest, recover, learn from what they did well and badly in that competition. So we don't want it to be at a constant level, because that's just unsustainable.
Okay, let's move on.
it's lightning round, right?
Yeah, it's lightning round. So the difference between competing as part of a team and competing mm-hmm. as an individual, you know, whether you are a tennis player or a football player, you're on a team or you're not. Is there a difference mm-hmm. in how you compete?
Well, everyone says there's a choice between competition and collaboration, but you said it exactly right. If you're on a team, you're collaborating with your teammates, but you're also competing against the other team. So the important thing is to understand that hierarchy. And research has actually found that 90% of a team's destiny happens before their very first meeting. It's 40 times more important to pick the right people and plan the team than it is managing or coaching them along the way.
Mm.
So the key is the right mix. I mean, the right team chemistry for NBA gets you a 6 extra game wins a year.
Right. So that means that this preseason or off-season planning is far more important than what goes on during the season, even on the practice field.
Absolutely.
You point out also a very important difference between playing to win and playing not to lose. How do those approaches affect the outcome?
Well, in playing to win, as we were talking earlier about challenge, playing to win is focusing on the good things that are going to be the outcome of the result. And if you're playing to win, you want to hear praise on what you're doing right because you're going to keep it going. You're not thinking about details. You just want the big picture. Playing not to lose is when you're thinking, oh my gosh, at some point I'm going to get caught and this is going to be a disaster. So you're focusing on preventing the disaster. So now you want to hear about the details. You want to hear about what you're doing wrong so you can fix it. Don't give me praise. Let's worry about every possible thing that could happen and those bad outcomes. And everybody says, oh, well, playing to win must be for winners and playing not to lose is for losers. But the number one kid in school, the number one company in the country could be saying, everybody's just waiting for me to screw up. And at some point I will. So it's really easy to switch to that sort of preventative mindset. And what we've got to do is remember that big picture of what we wanted to get out of something.
So does competition make us better in 5 seconds or less?
Yes, it does. Because it inspires us to new greats.
Ashley Merriman is co-author with Poe Bronson of Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. It's pretty fascinating, and it's a good read, so take a look at it. Thank you for the hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you.